It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Later on this hour, how a small organ concert in Claremont, Iowa turned into a pageant that brings local history to life. But first, we've all heard of dogs who are trained for police work, searching out contraband, explosives, and in search and rescue. But how about dogs used at archaeological digs? With me this hour are the founders of Samaritan Detection Dogs. They are using trained dogs to help in some unusual ways with archaeological research and conservation work. Jim Peters is one of the co-founders of the group. Hello, Jim.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for being here. Brett Sorrells is also a co-founder. He's also a police officer in Washington, Iowa. Hello, Brett.
Good morning.
And Mike Zoss is here as well, an Iowa historian who lives in Washington County. Hello, Mike.
Good morning.
And Jim, I think I'll start with you. Take me back to where the idea for this organization came from.
Probably just 3 or 4 years ago, Brett and I started having conversations about working on some investigations. We both love putting puzzles together and using dogs to do that. And as a part of that, we began to wonder out loud, how old of a burial could a dog actually locate? And we started playing around researching that. Brett had some contact information for Mike. We got in touch with Mike. Mike took us to a location in Washington County where he's familiar with burials there. And we began experimenting, and the dogs demonstrated the same behavior with some of these graves that are quite old that we would see with more modern burials. And I was at a position where I was ready to retire, and we talked more about forming a company and having something to do in the future, and that's how it was born.
So what is your background with dogs? I mean, you talked about wanting to work with dogs in this way. Is that something that you have experience doing?
Yes. I think I can't speak for Mike. I know Brett has grown up with dogs. I grew up with dogs. I actually grew up in Colorado until I was in middle school, but was raised in Iowa every summer as a child. Always spent my summers on the farm with the farm dogs and was fascinated with them and some of the friends that my relatives had here in Iowa who had hunting dogs. And when we moved back to Iowa, I got a dog immediately and have always had at least one dog. We have 5 dogs at our house right now.
Well, so I have a lot of dogs as well in my life, but I don't know that they've necessarily earned their keep in this way. Was there something about your dogs that made you think, I think they'd be really good at this type of work?
Yes, and My oldest search and rescue dog is about 4 and a half, and I adopted him as a puppy. I had Brett assess his potential. He looked really solid. And you can go through a lot of dogs trying to find the few that have the right temperament, the right drive. Brett could probably fill you in more on that. But it's a bit of a crapshoot. You don't know exactly what you've got when you take it home from the pound.
Well, and Brett, I know that you have worked with a dog as a police officer. How long have you been doing that?
I actually started the police canine program in Washington in about 2000, and I've been doing it. I still currently handle a dog there. So, and then that's how, as I was progressing through law enforcement with my dog, I was getting a lot of calls to different incidents where they were wanting a dog that would locate like a missing Alzheimer's patient or a missing child or just something of that nature, which really a police dog isn't trained to do that. They're usually after, you know, if you're going to do a track or something with a police dog, it's a quick thing where somebody's jumped out of a vehicle or somebody's committed a crime and you're trying to locate that. But with search and rescue, you know, a lot of times people don't even notify the authorities until 4, 5, 6 hours, maybe a day later. And police dogs really aren't geared for that. And I was just seeing a real need for it in our area because there was none. And so I had talked to my police chief and asked him if he thought it would be appropriate if I took this on and just trained a dog myself. And he agreed to that. And I found one and, you know, we ended up doing a lot of search and rescue. I joined a rescue team that actually Jim was a part of, and that's how we met. And I guess just because of our love of dogs, that kind of brought us in together on working on projects like this.
Interesting. And I know that as part of Samaritan Detection Dogs, you're also include search and rescue work in what you do. Is there any kind of concern about – I could see that as an area where the police would want perhaps control over what's going on. How do you work in partnership with local authorities?
Well, you know, when I show up, especially if it's a different agency, yes, I'm a police officer, but at that point I put that away and I become a dog handler. And, you know, I let them tell me where they want us to go, or I think Jim actually does the same thing. They take charge. We just follow out leads. We may give suggestions and things like that, but if it's their show, they run it.
What do you do to train a dog to be able to help in a search and rescue type situation?
Well, for training the dogs, of course, search and rescue, there's a lot of different areas you can do. You can do tracking. You can do an area search. And, of course, the human remains detection, which is, you know, probably the least fun of them. But it does happen. The tracking, you just basically have to start the dog out with the fundamentals of tracking and build on that and just continue. The area search is where the dog just sniffs the air to locate the person. Generally, you get them in so that the wind is in their face, and it's kind of amazing. They claim, and I believe that a dog can clear about an acre a minute. So, and then, of course, with the human remains, it's not as easy to train for that. But what we do is a lot of hair, a lot of teeth, fingernails. And we've actually had people that donate, females who've had children donate the placenta, and we can use that as a training aid.
In what way?
Well, the dog has to, for the human remains, the dog is picking up human decomposition, and so you can either start out separately with small, like blood or whatever, but eventually you can put these teeth, these fingernails, the hair, and like placenta all together. It's all human material that decomposes, and basically
that gives them the scent.
That gives them the scent. Exactly.
Interesting. And how long a process? I mean, I'm sure it's different with every dog. Some dogs have a great aptitude for this. Some dogs may take a little longer to learn. But how long a process is it to teach a dog to do this?
It's an ever-growing process. It never stops. If you think about it, the material that you use to train with, a lot of that has to be frozen. Once it's brought out, you set it out to train with it. And during that training session, it's decomposing. So you get done with that day, you put it away, you come back out, you do it the next day, it starts to thaw out, it starts to decompose. There's another, you know, training aid. It's actually different, but it's the same. So it's and you get creative as to where you put your hides and things like that. So it's just wherever you want to take it, you can really get creative.
Well, and of course, when we think about police dogs, we think about German Shepherds almost universally. Those are the canine police officers that we see. And Jim, you mentioned bringing a dog home from the animal shelter. So tell me a little bit about your dogs and where they came from, because that's not the kind of background I think a lot of us think of when we think about dogs involved in this kind of work.
All of the dogs that we're using have been donated or we rescued. And again, we look for temperament. Do they like people? What's their drive like? How long will they seek a toy if you throw it into the tall grass? How many times will they go look for that toy? We look for dogs in the working breeds that have a genetic history of helping humans, interacting with humans. And currently I have a 3-year-old Border Collie Blue Heeler that's trained for conservation work as well as human remains detection. And then I have a 2-year-old Red Heeler female. She's part Red Heeler, part She-Devil. She's pretty wild. These are the dogs that oftentimes end up at pounds or shelters. They're given up by families because they can't handle the rowdiness. And the rowdiness is the dog simply saying, I'm really bored. I need more to do. And so, again, we look for the working breeds. There are dogs that are not necessarily considered working breeds. For example, in Europe and even here in Iowa, the standard poodles have been used for drug work, for example. I know that folks are using the smaller dogs, beagles and different terriers, to do pest control work, to look for bed bugs and termites and that sort of thing. So, again, it's, as I mentioned earlier, it's a bit of a crapshoot. You don't know what you have until you spend a little bit of time with them. I don't know what Brett's experience has been. I've adopted a number of dogs who just didn't have it. We had a yellow lab. Yellow labs are great dogs. This particular dog walked in our house, said, oh, you have a couch. I'm good. This is where I'm going to spend the rest of my life playing with your little kids. And it worked out great, but she just didn't have the drive to do this kind of work.
Well, we're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm talking to the founders of Samaritan Detection Dogs, Jim Peters and Brett Sorrells. Mike Zoss is also here with us. He's an Iowa historian who lives in Washington County, and we'll talk about how these dogs got involved in archaeological work in just a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Right now I'm talking with the founders of Samaritan Detection Dogs. They're using trained dogs to help out with archaeological research, conservation work, and also some search and rescue work as well. Jim Peters is one of the co-founders of the group. Brett Sorrells is also a co-founder and a police officer in Washington, Iowa. And Mike Zoss is an Iowa historian who lives in Washington County. And I want to talk about the archaeological part of this. We've talked a little bit about search and rescue. It makes a lot of sense to use a trained dog to look for human remains that are fairly recent. How did you get the idea to use dogs to look for human remains that could be decades or even older than that? Where did that idea come from? Mike, I guess it's you.
Well, Brett called me and asked if I could recommend a site where there would be human remains that we were pretty sure of how long they had been there and over a long period of time. And we met and brought the dogs to a site that happens to be on one of my cousin's farms. It's a private location, so we won't say where it's at. But there are burials there that are about 150 years old. There are burials about 200 to 500 years old. And then there are burials that are 2,000 years old,
okay,
all in the same general area. And so we had a variety of things to investigate. And I had not worked with I've always had a dog, but I've not worked with dogs in this capacity. Well, I guess no one really had at that point. But we took the dogs to this spot individually. And I was probably standing with my mouth open all the time because it was just amazing. And every dog found the same things. So it wasn't just that this one found something here and this one something here. They all zeroed in on what appeared to be a place where there were more recent burials, but my favorite was where there was a burial that we knew was pretty much 2,000 years ago, and every dog located that.
All right. And when the dogs locate that, what do they do? What does that look like?
Well, each dog has their own way of telling their trainer what they have.
Okay. So Jim, give me an example. One of your dogs, what would they do?
My two little dogs, because of their size and we're frequently out in brush and the timber or prairie, I've taught them to do a sit bark. They'll stay at that location and bark. My larger German Shepherd that I also use for search and rescue, because he's 95 pounds, his bark can be pretty intimidating if we're involved in search and rescue. So he just does a drop. He goes down on his chest and elbows. Brett's dog does a bark, and that's their response to us. That's their trained alert.
So the dogs knew that they were looking for human remains. That's what that was.
Sure.
Right. And so thinking about human remains that are 2,000 years old, now I don't have the nose of a dog, but that seems like most of the odors that would tell me that those remains were there would be long gone by then. What are the dogs looking for? What can they detect?
Well, it might seem odd to some people, but there are a number of academic institutions and scientists that research human decomposition. And in 2008, a fellow in Tennessee, I believe, published his research where they had, not using dogs but using instruments, had detected almost 500 different volatile organic compounds that came off of human decomposition. Some of those are moving through evaporation and some of those are moving through sublimation. And of those nearly 500, about 60 of those were detected at the surface or on top of the burial. And we don't know exactly which of the volatile organic compounds or VOCs the dogs are sorting through, but they're clearly getting something. And so as the body decomposes, those molecules, this all happens at the molecular level, and it's actually science in action. Some of those VOCs will bind to the chemicals in the soil as they make their way to the surface, and then they'll reside there in perpetuity. We're fortunate here in the Midwest that the soil is generally humid. The atmosphere has generally got some humidity in it. In desert environments, it appears that the dogs are having a little more difficulty. The soil isn't as rich and it doesn't have the same chemical composition.
Mm-hmm. So Iowa may be just the right place for this kind of work.
at least non-arid areas, yes.
So once you went through this exercise, what kind of reaction did you have? I mean, you said your jaw was just hanging open the whole day. But, I mean, to even give this a try, you must have suspected that it was going to work. Jim, how did you respond?
I was like Mike. I was fascinated and maybe even a little bit giddy. It's always fun to spend a day in the woods with a dog, particularly if there's some objectives and you never know exactly what you're going to get. And it was quite exciting.
Brett, what was your reaction?
I was, you know, I'm not a real excitable person, but I was pretty happy. When my dog went in, I watched her and she started making circles in a certain area. And I believe at the time she was working clockwise, but the circles just kept getting tighter and tighter. And I was like, oh, man, you know, I'm seeing it, but I'm not believing it. And it was just really an amazing thing. And, yeah, I thought they could do it, but I wasn't sure we was gonna have to maybe work on it more.
Right.
But they picked it up, and it was very interesting.
Wow. So that must have felt almost magical to see that happen.
The site that we were working at has middle woodland Indian mounds that go back 2,000 years. Most people think that mounds were for burial. Mounds had a number of different purposes. They could be boundary markers, they could be ceremonial, and they could be burial. So there's close to 20 mounds on this site. But some of them arouse no interest in the dogs at all. Well, those would be ones that had not been used for burial. But they all zeroed in on one mound in particular. And what blew me away is that every dog looked up into a tree. And I thought, well, there must have been a squirrel there. And the dog guy said, no, the tree absorbs some of those human molecules, and the dog could smell it going up into
wow.
the tree.
So after that experience, what kind of potential did you see for this kind of work with your dogs, and how did you go about getting the word out to archaeologists or other people who might want to use your services, Jim?
Well, we just began networking like any other new business, and I got a list of archaeology firms in the state and sent out some emails, and in one instance that day I got a call within 5 minutes of sending that email from an archaeology firm, and we have done a couple of projects with them. What we should point out is that if a human is decomposed in a particular area and then the remnants of the body, the bones, for example, were removed, there's still going to be volatile organic compounds in the soil where the body has liquefied and leached into the soil. And so there may not actually be a body there, but there may still be remnants of the decomposition.
Interesting. So can you give me an example of a kind of case you've worked on?
Well, all across the nation, there are federal laws that say if you're going to be developing in a particular area and there's historical documentation that says there may be an pioneer cemetery or native burials in that area, you have to do these different phases of surveys. And first of all, it starts with the historical documents. And then there may be satellite imagery, and then they do what's called a pedestrian survey where they walk the area to look for shapes that may indicate that there's been a burial there. And we're not replacing any of that. We're just adding another layer of confidence to their survey work that, oh, yeah, the dogs are indicating that there's human decomposition here, or there has been human decomposition here.
I can imagine the possibility of finding pioneer graves. Many people have pioneer graves on their property and may know that or may not know that, may not know the location of those graves. Give me an idea of some of the other things that you think your dogs could be involved in this work.
Well, veering away from archaeology for just a moment, we did a project with the DNR this summer looking for Blanding's turtles who are endangered, and there was one particular area that the DNR wanted to assess for population, and we spent probably a few days a week over 7 weeks researching that area. The dogs were trained to look for blandings using blanding material specifically. We didn't find any. We found a lot of painted turtles, for example. And remarkably, the dogs did not demonstrate their trained alert on the painted turtles because
they could tell the difference between Blanding's turtles and painted turtles.
Yeah, it's pretty fascinating stuff. We also did a project looking for an invasive weed, garlic mustard, in the spring. And if you, as a human, walk out into the woods in the spring, there's countless types of vegetation there. And it can be challenging for humans to eradicate some of these invasive weeds just because there's so much on the surface to try to sort through. And we trained one of the little dogs on garlic mustard using actual garlic mustard plants. In about 2.5-3 weeks, he was reliably locating that material out in the woods.
Wow.
And again, that's all based on volatile organic compounds.
So As word is spreading, I mean, you must have some ideas for things your dogs can do, but are people coming to you with some of these unique projects? I mean, did, for example, with the conservation work, was that your idea or did the DNR think of that?
Actually, I was approached, and we're not really breaking new ground. Perhaps in Iowa we might be, but there are a few other folks that have been using dogs for conservation work for up to a decade. With the archaeology work, we've not been able to find many other organizations that are doing that. I've made friends with a number of archaeologists, and a number of them have frankly been politely skeptical, but they are starting to understand the science, like Mike, and he saw it with his own eyes.
Brett, can you give me an idea of some of the things that you might look forward to working on now or in the future after retirement when you may have a little more time for this kind of work? I mean, we've talked about long ago human remains, but reawakening some cold cases is something you would like to do as well, right?
Yeah, I like the cold case. My preference as far as working dogs is pretty much to find missing humans or, you know, unlocated humans, whether it be the archaeology or the cold case. That's definitely where I like to be.
We have an email from Stephanie in Cedar Rapids. She says, I'm curious, since the dogs can detect human remains as old as 2,000 years, what sort of difficulties battlegrounds present if there are hundreds or thousands of bodies that have decomposed in an area? How is it possible for the dog to locate anything specific? Is that a situation that would be too overwhelming for a dog to work through?
I think it would be yes. I mean, you think about it, there's blood. I'm sure that some of the bodies were, you know, in battlegrounds where flesh has been removed or whatever. It's going to be difficult. It's going to flood the area with that type of material. So to actually pinpoint any certain specific person, it's going to be difficult.
Yeah, it would be a kind of an olfactory landfill.
Just a complete overload.
Yeah.
And we've seen that in some training scenarios. We know where there's some unmarked pioneer cemeteries where there are numerous graves, and the dogs will circle and throw, we call it throwing an alert, throw various variety of alerts in a larger area, 1 or 2 acre area.
What I could see is if the dog could locate, say, a pioneer cemetery, then using other means we could map that and find out how many burials are there. But sometimes that's hard to find that location, whereas the dog could narrow some of those
certainly
things
down. The archaeologists follow up with their geotechnical equipment.
You talked about the fact that dogs can be so incredibly fast about this work. And I think, for example, in search and rescue work, you have some great examples of how quickly a dog can do something that a human cannot do. Can you give me an example of how that works in a search and rescue type situation, just to give us an idea of how effective these dogs can be? Brett?
Well, I think what you're trying to ask is how they can do it so quickly is that these molecules and things are floating in the air, especially – you know, when we talk about clearing an acre in a minute, that's usually for the area search. But that area search is used in, you know, all kinds of situations. But the wind will pick up these molecules and disperse them through the air. The dogs, you know, have I don't know how many thousands of receptors in the nose, but they can. It just takes one molecule to trigger that receptor for them to say, hey, I've got something. And then they just work what's called a scent cone. And it's fun to watch because it's like back and forth in and out of the scent. And you can actually physically see this when they're working it.
Well, and let's talk about seeing it in action. I know there was a young girl who was missing. She'd been missing for 5 hours. And you guys got involved in that search. What happened?
There was a missing girl. I think she was 2 or 3 years old, and she'd been missing for 5 hours. They had 200 searchers on the ground. They had helicopters flying over. And it was, I think it was summertime or close to fall. But so the foliage was full, and the cornfields were full and thick, and the people had just, you know, were exhausted. They called me and said, hey, you know, can you bring a dog? And I said, sure, I'll bring a dog. And I got downwind and started walking with my dog and put her into a position that she was getting some wind in her face. Actually laid her down in an open area and just let her sit for a little while. And it was amazing. I'd just seen her head kind of snap. And the person that was with me, I said, she's got the dog has the girl located. And he just looked at me. He says, how can you tell? And I said, she just locked on to her odor. And he was trying to watch, but he couldn't see it. And then she did it again. And I went ahead and told her, go find. And within a matter of seconds, she was with the little girl sitting on her lap.
So hundreds of people searching for 5 hours, couldn't find anything, and a dog could do it in about 20 minutes.
Yeah.
That's incredible. Thank you all so much for being here today.
Thank you.
I've been talking to the co-founders of Samaritan Detection Dogs, Jim Peters and Brett Sorrells. Mike Zoss was also here, an Iowa historian who lives in Washington County. Coming up in just a moment, keeping history alive through music. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Historians and amateur historians everywhere work hard to research, document, understand, and protect local history. Steve Story does all of that, and he brings history to life through stories and music. Every year since 1992, he's been putting on a program that celebrates the history of the northeastern Iowa town of Claremont, population 620. Steve is 83 years old, and he is still at it. This year's production will be on Sunday, August 28th at 2:30 p.m. at the Union Sunday School in Claremont, and it will focus on World War I. Before we hear from Steve, we asked his daughter, Janet Schlopkohl, who's a playwright who lives in the Iowa City area, to set the scene for us. We asked her to describe what these productions are like and to share a couple of her favorite memories.
So you drive into Claremont, kind of following along a little lazy river up in northeast Iowa, and you're immediately struck by the fact that this is a town with the storefronts, brick buildings that look like they haven't changed really that much since turn of the century, which is in fact true. There's a lot of the buildings that date back to the Civil War era. And the next thing that you'll notice is that there's a shocking number of statues of people. And this is an unusual thing also for the town. If you turn the corner and you go to the church, and on any concert day, the next thing that you'll see is people gathered outside in period dress. So it would be very surprising if you didn't know there was a concert going on to drive by the church and you'll see people with top hats on and coattails, people who do dress up like 1860s Civil War era. And they're standing outside this really adorable small Sunday school building. It's called the Sunday school building because that's exactly what it served. That was the purpose that it has. It's not a church. It was served for their Sunday school classes. So then the next thing that you'd see is like a lot of people gathering along the street and walking. You think, well, what's going on? Is there a parade or something in town? And everybody's filing into this church. You're greeted outside by people also in costume. And then it's surprising, you'd think organ concerts in northeast Iowa, small rural community, why are there so many people here? But they're coming to see other people in the community who participate in these. So their friends, their teachers, the veterinarian, school teachers are all participating in, they're all involved in the program, singing in the choir and reenacting scenes. So the other thing that's very interesting is that the church gets packed, really, the Sunday school building gets packed really quickly with people waiting for this to begin. And then there's music, and this, I think, is a key part of the program's success. There are very few opportunities for people to get to sing along with something anymore when you think about it. If you don't go to church regularly, when do you ever sing with a group of other people? And I mean, really rarely, if ever. And there are songs that are kind of folk songs, Stephen Foster songs I can remember from one of the concerts, and other songs that people may not know that well, but there's music provided and you can sing along. The choir usually sings one song, verse first, so that you have the opportunity to learn the tune, and then you're holding the music, and the audience is always encouraged to participate. So it's a comfortable audience participation for people who maybe are not musicians because it's being picked up by everybody around you, and then this group of performers as well. So there'll be a little bit of talking. Everybody is playing a character who actually lived in the time period and most often from that very area. So in a couple of the concerts, they've actually had family members who, you know, it was their great-grandfather who was being portrayed, who've come from some distance to be there. I do have a lot of favorite memories because since it started when the kids were so little and moved through the grandchildren, there's a lot of different times you just remember sitting by somebody in particular, different moments, like when my mother and my aunt, they're twins, identical twins, were in one where they played war widows, and they are also seamstresses. They're very talented seamstresses. I don't think there's anything they can't do, actually. And they came down the aisle as the widows of one of the characters. And it was a really powerful moment. They had beautiful, full 18, you know, Civil War era mourning dress on. And it was just a very powerful moment. As diminutive as they are, it was a remarkable moment. And then another favorite memory is when my father did the circus performance or concert, my son-in-law and I had a papier-mâché cardboard box elephant that I had used in another show, and it was going to wrap at the window with its trunk. It had a movable trunk. So my son-in-law and I both needed to lift it up, me inside and he in the outside. Problem was, we couldn't entirely hear our cue from inside the elephant outside the church. So I think the elephant jumped its cue. I believe we were early. So we could actually hear the audience sort of gasp from inside when they saw this. It was, I failed to mention, it was nearly life size. So it was a very shocking thing for the people inside to see it lift its trunk up and then tap at the window inside the church. So I think that was, because it just felt so ridiculous. Here we were inside a papier-mâché cardboard elephant outside the church in this very small town, waiting for a cue so that the elephant would appear at the window.
That's Janet Schlopkohl talking about the productions her father, Steve Story, puts on in Claremont each year. I also talked to Steve. I asked him to take us back to 1992 and to tell me how all of this got started.
So because they're having people play the organ down at Union Sunday School, and that's an honor to be able to ask to play there, they say, well, give him a try. So I was asked, would you put on a program next year? And I said, well, I don't know, but I think what I did. So I'd make it real short. I went all down to the University of Iowa. I looked up two famous people who had traveled to England to sell Christianity and looked up what they did, brought it back, and so the concert was on, basically, the music taken to England, and then they liked that. It was something that was not just good for them. They enjoyed it. And that's why from then on, we've always had a script. And we've had people, I've had four of them always, they do some of the singing, and it goes over well. So that's what we do.
So I think you may be underselling this just a little bit, because I mean, they asked you to put on an organ concert, and so you started doing historical research about people from Claremont, Iowa, who had traveled to England, and then you found appropriate music that you could play, and things just seemed to snowball from there. Give me a little bit idea of, actually, we do have some audio from one of your performances in 2009, and this is from a performance called Ringling Brothers and Buffalo Bill's Wild West Come to Claremont.
Oh, yes.
So tell me a little bit about this. I mean, this, you'd been at it for quite a while, but this was a pretty research-intensive program that you put on.
And so I knew I liked all those kind of things. So I wrote a script, got the music, got the community, got some kids who could do some things, got some adults who could do some things. We had clowns. We had a whole bunch of people. Places packed, obviously.
Well,
I enjoy it.
I have the program from that day, and you had 30 people involved in putting on that program. That's a far cry from just playing an organ concert.
Yes, we do. You know, I find out that people, some of them like to get involved in something like that, something they can do, just get the word out. Well, we'll help you out. We'll come and we'll be there. Don't worry. We'll help you. And this goes over really, really well.
Well, let's play just a little bit of audio from that performance. Again, this is Ringling Brothers and Buffalo Bill's Wild West Come to Claremont, a performance from 2009.
Sitting Bull called her, and named her, he called her Little Sure Shot.
She is.
Right.
And I'm going to ask Frank Butler, who is still in love with his Bruna, Art. Sing, Let Me Call You Sweetheart, and you will be invited to sing also at the appropriate time.
I am dreaming.
Now, I also, of course, heard the organ there, the organ that, that started this whole thing, and it's a pretty special instrument. Can you tell me about the organ that you play?
Well, yes, it's a Kimball organ. It has 1,554 pipes. It's been restored in the year 2010 by a firm here in Iowa. Two keyboards. It plays quite well. People like to play it. It's one thing I would say, it is a very tight organ in that if you just touch the key, it's going to play the note. So you have to be really careful not to depress the notes like you would for a piano. That's just something that's unique about this. The people who come here who are professionals all notice that right away. Uh-oh, got to be really careful and touch them. We don't want to have to push it down for all the way.
And okay. So the organ is 120 years old.
Well, I did the math. That would be pretty much the case. 1996 up to 16, that would sound that way to me.
How do you pick the music?
Well, I go look for music that I think would be unique. Now, this Sunday coming up, we're going to bring songs that were the national anthems at the time, not today, at the time, for the Germans and the British and the French and the Italians and various other countries. We're going to play that music, and we're going to play it in the language of that country.
Oh, wow. So, and that I mentioned earlier that this program is focusing on World War One. So, we talked about singing along earlier. That's going to be a lot more challenging for people to sing along if they are singing national anthems that they may not have heard before in languages they don't speak.
Well, here's the deal. Our teacher, who's the music teacher at North Fayette High School, outstanding, and so is his wife and a couple others, he can speak German fluently. So, for example, we're going to open up right off the bat with the song of the Germans that they used for their anthems, and they're going to sing one or two verses, and then we're going to go into the English translation. So we're going to be translating also, so the people can jump in then and translate if they wish to, which they will undoubtedly do, I'm sure.
World War One was a time in Iowa that really divided a lot of people because we did have so many German immigrants who lived here, and there was a lot of misunderstanding or a lot of mistrust of people who'd come from Germany because the war was going on. It sounds like in the stories that you're trying to present, you're trying to cross those national boundaries.
That's exactly right. And so we had the same situation. When the war broke out, there were people in the county, Germans, some not Germans, but they resented some things they saw. Some of them, not too many up here, more down in eastern Iowa, went ahead and painted yellow paint on their farmer's barn, one thing they might have done. The Lutheran ministers had a bit of a problem. Should we keep on going with our own language, or should we go to the English language? There were meetings held on that topic. The governor of Iowa had some feelings very strong about that. There were many things. Like some people got arrested because they said some bad things about the war. You look at the paper as well. So it was a tough time for them. They've been here in great numbers since the 1860s. But now here, they got some families over there. They don't want to see their own families killed. It's awful, just awful.
So are you already thinking about next year's performance, or do you have to get through this one first?
Well, I want to make sure I get through this one. I just don't know. I am a bit older than I was before, obviously. But it's been a joy to work with these things. We've had other places we've taken shows like that. But what I find out is if people like to be in things, and if they want to be, give them a chance. And they're good. They're very, very good. We did a lot of religious programs. We did with names on them that caught the eye of what it was like. How about we had one where they were all found up in heaven, and they were making up their program for a concert in heaven. Good singers we had. And so that's what it was.
I've been talking with Steve Story. Every year he puts on a production in the very small town of Claremont, Iowa, northeastern Iowa. He's been doing these productions since 1992, and this year's program is coming up on Sunday, August 28th. The program this year will focus on World War I, the history and the music of that time period in the area. And with me now is Doug Poppin. He is a resident of West Union, and he's also a high school music instructor, and he's worked with Steve on these productions since the very beginning. Hello, Doug.
Hello.
Thank you so much for talking with me. And I want to go back to the start. I talked to Steve about how this whole idea came about, and I'd love to hear your perspective, because this certainly grew way past a little organ concert.
Yes, it did. And Steve was the high school principal when I was hired here in West Union at North Fayette High School in the fall, well, actually the summer of 1986. And Steve has always been not only a mentor, but someone that I've looked up to with immense pride with everything that he's taught me along the way. And so when he came to me with the idea of doing this concert, as you say, in 1992, Steve is one of those people that I'm not able to say no to for anything. But it's really grown into a labor of love. I've really enjoyed doing it.
Is there anything that you've learned about the history of the area that has really surprised you?
A tremendous amount. I grew up in northern Illinois, and so coming to northeast Iowa, I knew of some things that this area of the country was famous for, but I had no idea of the immense historical treasures that we have in right in our backyard here, especially with Claremont and the ties with Governor Larrabee and many of the other political figures in the late 1800s and early 1900s. It was really a wealth of talented people that were involved in shaping not only northeastern Iowa, but actually the landscape of the entire Midwest here.
Well, thank you so much for talking with me, and I hope you have a great performance this weekend.
Thank you. I'm looking forward to it.
This year's production will be on Sunday, August 28th at 2:30 p.m. at the Union Sunday School in Claremont, and it will focus on World War I. Talk of Iowa is produced by Emily Woodbury, Dennis Reese, Claire Roth, and Lindsay Moon. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. I'm Charity Nebbe. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.